Welcome to Political Pivoting, Literary Publishing at the Pace of Politics. I'm Paul Reyes, editor of BQR. I'll be your moderator this afternoon. This panel is brought to you by CLMP, the Community of Literary Magazines and Presses, the National Service Organization for Independent Literary Publishing. This year, CLMP celebrates its 50th anniversary, so if you want to learn more, go to clmp.org. Our panelists today, Neera Sharma, Johnny Temple, and Amanda Johnston. And I'll have each of you just briefly introduce yourselves, since they already have your bios and your programs, and then after that we can just dive right in. So if you want to tell us a little bit about what you do and the intersection with this panel and this theme.
Sure. Yeah, my name is Neera Sharma. I'm a senior nonfiction editor at Guernica magazine. I'm also a writer and a radio producer. Guernica is a magazine of global arts and politics, which is kind of everything, really. And we strive to publish work that is political, but also has staying power and longevity. And so we're kind of right in the sweet spot of this discussion.
Cool. Hi, everybody. I'm Johnny Temple. I'm the publisher and editor-in-chief at Akashic Books, based in Brooklyn, New York. We're a literary publishing house. We publish about 35 books a year. We have various areas of focus, including Caribbean literature, more broadly, literature from the African diaspora, Latin American literature, LGBTQ authors. But that's not the whole of it. Those are just some of the areas of emphasis. I'm also one of the founders and main organizers of the annual Brooklyn Book Festival, which happens every September. This September, the 15th and 16th, will be our 13th Brooklyn Book Festival. And in my efforts as both a book publisher and a book festival organizer, social justice issues are always at the forefront.
And I'm Amanda Johnston. I am the founder of Torch Literary Arts. It's a nonprofit organization dedicated to Black girls and women, supporting them through creative writing. I'm also co-founder of Black Poets Speak Out, which is an international campaign that rallies poets to speak out and unite against police violence.
Thank you. And I think because, you know, it is such an intimate gathering today, I would encourage you all just to raise your hand and feel free to jump in with questions as we're talking. There's no need to compartmentalize that portion of the program. So I want to begin with this, basically with the premise of the panel. I think at the heart of it is this idea that there's this inevitable tension between political coverage and literary craft. And I think for the most part, that's true. The idea of the pace of politics is fast, and in terms of trying to keep up with it, one has to be nimble. But the line that separates the two is also pretty porous. And so maybe we should begin with challenging this idea that there's necessarily this tension. And any of you can jump in, but does keeping pace with the frenetic narrative of American politics necessarily betray literary values? Mira?
Sure. Can you hear me? Okay, then do I need... Okay.
Well, we're going to speak directly into the microphones
That's
for the podcast.
I think there are many ways to answer this question, but basically my answer is no. I don't see sort of political issues and the literary world and literary values on two separate sides of a spectrum. And I think, the idea of keeping up with politics is something that I think Guernica has dispensed with entirely, because it's not who we are to sort of react and respond to the news cycle. That's just not our mandate. We're publishing long-form, deeply reported, or deeply personal and political pieces of journalism, essays, as well as fiction and poetry, and especially in this political moment, I think remembering that, and also realizing that we just don't have the resources to react and respond constantly, is actually in a way really freeing, because we're publishing work that reflects our interests, our tastes, what we think is important, and we just aren't, because we don't have any money and we don't really we don't spend that much money and we don't earn that much money, so we're not responding to any market or external forces. So I guess I think right now everybody is reading more media. I mean, we're seeing that across the board, and a lot of that is political in nature, but I think remembering that we are a certain kind of publication and we need to kind of do what we do best and sort of stay in our lane in that regard is one way to answer that question.
I feel very similar at Akashic Books. I remember soon after Trump was elected, Publishers Weekly called me and said, you know, we're doing an article about how publishers are responding or planning to respond to the Trump's victory and how that's going to affect your publishing program. And I thought, it's not going to affect us very much. I don't feel the need to respond. I mean, we were a publisher for 8 years while George W. Bush was president, and for how horrible and terrifying Donald Trump is, he hasn't done anything nearly as bad as what George W. Bush did, which led to the death of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and other people and other terrible things. I'm not defending Trump. I'm just saying that we do what we do. I think if anything, maybe it affirms, you know, Trump's victory affirms for me the importance of what we do, which is shining a light on voices, important voices that might otherwise not you know, get heard. But that's what we do, and it's what we're going to continue to do. So while sometimes we do publish nonfiction books, you know, that touch upon current events and whatnot, that's what we're going to be doing while Obama's president. It was what we'll do while Trump is president. We'll all be much more bummed out and somber and sullen during the Trump presidency and have to find ways to keep our chin up in a completely bleak political landscape. But in terms of our actual publishing output, we're publishing the best authors we can find, and that's what we're going to continue doing. One other thing to say is we get proposals all the time now for books about Trump, you know, and it's like, I'm not saying we're not going to publish any books dealing with Trump, but I'm not so drawn to that. And I also know that a lot of other publishing companies are going to be doing that. And our mission at Akashic, we're not trying to be redundant with what other people are doing. We have just recently, like a few weeks ago, published a fantastic, a nonfiction book by former NBA national, you know, basketball player Etan Thomas, who was played in the NBA for about 11 years, most of that for the Washington Wizards, and he's been a political activist for pretty much his whole life, but he was the first professional athlete to speak out against George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq. And so what he has done, the book is called We Matter, Athletes and Activism, and he has interviewed 50, mostly athletes, but also some media figures and some team owners, and talking with them around a variety of issues. And he's also interviewed family members of people who have been killed by the police, like Trayvon Martin's family members and whatnot. And just looking at the sort of state of athletes and political activism, as probably everyone in the room knows, athletes have become increasingly vocal in the past couple of years. As we were sending the book to print, Etan called me up and he said, maybe we should change the subtitle from athletes and activism to athletes and activism in the age of Trump. And I said, I said, it's your call, but I don't really like that idea for two reasons. One, it sort of dates the book, and to me, I want to be publishing books that are going to continue to sell year after year after year. But secondly, why would we want to put that ugly-ass word on the cover of the book? You know, I don't want the word Trump on the cover of your book. And he was like, yeah, you're totally right. And so we went without it. So in a sense, that was almost like a stepping away from making the book seem, you know, hyper current.
Mm-hmm. In the work that I do with Torch Literary Arts and as an organizer for Black Poets Speak Out, it's never been about chasing whatever the political climate is. First and foremost, it's about showing up for the people. Politics really only come into play for me and how it has an effect on people's lives, especially people of color, especially poor people, especially marginalized people, women and children. So when you listen, you show up with whatever resources you have to turn over and not try to guide or turn or navigate the conversation in a structured way. If you just listen and give space for people to come with their work, you'll find some very interesting stuff that is speaking to our time, that is speaking to what's relevant in the world. And it might be something that's more direct and pointed, because when we say politics, that's a whole big thing. It's not just Trump. It's not just the current administration. It's not only police violence. It's everything. And that can manifest in, you know, all different types of writing. But one thing I shy away from and I run away from calls that are so pointed that you can feel it's disingenuous. You're not really listening or are giving depth around the conversation of what's happening. And you're definitely not seeing the people. You're seeing a moment where this could be profitable. This could be sellable. I could turn this into something good for personal wealth or growth or whatever. And that's what concerns me most, is how we're using our power. I often say in my work, how are we using our power and privilege to break down power and privilege? So if you've been doing the same thing over and over again, take risks. And they are real risks, because I know there's also businesses behind this. You know, I don't have money. We're not working with money, but other organizations are. You have to be able to pay print costs. You have to be able to pay salaries. You have to be able to do all of those things. But I think we're at a time where we understand that showing up for people and documenting those stories through creative writing and nonfiction is important. And you know, sometimes the story that might not seem like it's going to get the most buzz is actually the most important one that you need to listen to and back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that leads me to this next question, Amanda, you in particular. You know, the other aspect of this panel that intrigues me is the idea of what a publisher is. And especially in 2018, there are various platforms by which we can disseminate this information. And so I wonder if you could speak to how you made the choices that you made. For instance, you know, an anthology of African-American poets responding to a particular crisis, that experience of the poem on the page is radically different than witnessing it either on the iPhone or in person, mm-hmm. Through, you know, social media. And I like that. And I wonder if each of you could speak to the dynamics behind your ventures, but in particular, how you chose that one.
Again, so what he's referring to is Black Poets Speak Out. I'll just give a quick little background about that if you're not familiar. Black Poets Speak Out started in 2014 after the murder of Mike Brown in Ferguson. And myself and other Cave Canem fellows on a private group started talking about what could we do. So myself, Mahogany Brown, Jericho Brown, Sharina Rodriguez Sharp, and John Terry Gadsden were the main people to come forward and say, okay, I will put whatever resources I have, time, sweat, let's formulate this into something that is accessible. And that's off, you know, that accessibility somehow has this history of being a bad thing. I don't understand that. But we knew we weren't alone in that pain, in that grieving, and we wanted to be in conversation with each other. So we wanted it to be fast and something that was accessible that anyone could participate in. So we started recording videos of ourselves reading poems by other Black poets, some reading our own poems, but unified that with a mantra that everyone said at the beginning to unify it globally, which is to state your name, and so I'll just do it. My name is Amanda Johnston. I'm a Black poet who will not remain silent while this nation murders Black people. I have a right to be angry. So we wanted to do that in a way that, one, you had to take a risk. At first, when we were talking about it, people wanted to direct you to this place that had published this poem by them that spoke to something of that nature. But it was still very hands-off. But this was urgent because it wasn't only about the poetry. The poetry was a vehicle to say, I'm still alive while I'm witnessing this country try to murder me and my family. Within Kaveh Kanem and other communities of people of color, it was not observing something happening in our country. It was waking up and preparing to go to our friends' funerals, waking up and going to see that our family members were not there anymore. Several people in our community have lost family members to police violence. So the choice then for it to be online was purely for the ease and access and speed at which it could be spread. Everybody has a phone, got phones, got laptops, whatever. We all have some device right there close to us that we can record ourselves. And once we did that, I wanna say, on Black Friday, right after the murder, and that was Thanksgiving Day week. Within 3 days, there were hundreds of videos around the world of people joining in. And I think what made that work so well was that it was not there wasn't a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. We put out the call and just the guidelines to the world, and people participated. And we have archived all of those videos, and there's still more coming on blackpoetspeakout.org. And you can see there are, my mama did a video. Let me say, my mama, both of my daughters did videos. They are not poets, but they are Black people. This is a Black family, and my mother is white, but she has a Black family, and we know how serious this is, right? So they were able to commit and participate in that way. But then you also have Marilyn Nelson read a portion of A Wreath for Emmett Till, and how that tied back into, you know, from that moment, that murder, that lynching of Emmett Till, directly correlated to everything that we're that's happening now, and to see that thread unbroken because of the poetry, that you could go back and pull it right back up today like it was brand new, sadly. But you were able to look then at that technology and all those videos and see this isn't it's not cornered off into one area. It is affecting us all, Black people in particular, but as human beings, this is a crisis that we should all be urgently drawn to. So, and no money. We go back to keep saying no money. We're a campaign. We're not a nonprofit. We're not an organization like that at all. We don't deal in money. And yeah, that also freed us a lot. We didn't have to worry about taxes or paying who got paid what and reportings. None of that.
Right, and I'll say I'm a proud Luddite. But I don't know of any other way I could have experienced that. I mean, in terms of producing it on the page, just it's different. I mean, it's witnessing versus reading. So, do you want to? Either of you have a response?
Sure. Go back to your question of sort of what does it mean to be publishing literary work, and in my case, literary journalism in 2018. I mean, what is literary journalism? It's bringing a sense of imagination, a sense of creativity to real issues, in a way that prioritizes depth and nuance and historical context and upending conventional wisdom and being honest. And I think all of those things are so important right now. And we see what happens. I mean, we've seen so many examples in the last couple of years of really kind of irresponsible journalism that mm-hmm. is so reactive and does things like, you know, acts as though the alt-right is this brand new thing, or acts as though white supremacists in this country is a brand new thing. I mean, we see this happening because there is this there is this reactive kind of like, I need to now go figure out what this thing is without doing the work of stepping back. And so again, I mean, I think literary journalism is always important, but I think remembering that, like, actually right now it's crucially important in this heightened kind of media environment. And I think the other thing that I've been thinking about a lot recently is being a publisher, being a sort of editor or gatekeeper in this moment, I think also means prioritizing or making a real effort to publish global stories as well, because I think we all feel this happening, this kind of inward looking, this kind of sense of everything that is happening in our politics is so terrible and so intense that it's easy to sort of block out the rest of the world and kind of become more and more self-centered as a country. And I think a way to push back on that is to tell global stories, is to shine a light on a really interesting community in Bolivia, or do a really in-depth piece on Eritrean refugees. And all of these issues are linked and are relevant in this moment. But I think remembering that one of my jobs is to publish pieces that really teach people something and expand their sense of the world, and don't just kind of continue to fuel the same conversations that are happening across the media.
All of us have benefited. What both of you were saying or have just said reminds me that all of us have benefited from this democratizing power of technology. As it advances, it becomes cheaper, we're able to do what we do. Everyone here at the table has benefited from that. And I wonder if each of you could speak to how, and we also talk about limited resources, and I wonder if you could speak to how you manage those resources to tackle what you want to tackle. Because I'm sure that there are, and maybe the second part of that question as a follow-up is, are there stories that, or just ideas or projects that you let go of because they're just impractical? I mean, I know, for instance, at VQR, there are plenty of ideas that we would love to address, but based on our resources, we just can't do it unless we do it in a very specific way, just because the staff is small, the budget is tight. The impulse and the drive and the desire to engage, whatever that happens to be, doesn't go away. So maybe, Johnny, you could start.
Yeah. I don't... Yeah, what you're asking and what you're saying makes complete sense. I don't have too much to say. In terms of managing resources at Akashic Books, our biggest resource is our own time. Mm-hmm. And that's the most powerful resource that we have. And the most limited one that we have, more limited than our small budgets. There's so much to do. There's so much work to do, whether it's publishing literary work or publishing work related to social justice, everything that we do. Fortunately for my company, I'm a total workaholic. I'm compelled to work constantly. Being able to read and edit, well, that actually doesn't happen during the office hours, and it's like one of the secrets of in the publishing world, is that I think people who don't interact much with the publishing world assume that if you work at a publishing company, you're sitting there like reading and editing all day, but you're not. You're in front of a computer like everybody else, sending out emails, reviewing documents, all this and that. And then you go home, and then after work, and that's when you do your reading and your editing, which is like the best part of the job, but that doesn't actually happen during the normal office hours. And then your partner says, "Honey, you're not at work anymore." To which you say, "I'm not working, I'm reading." And I think that almost everybody in the publishing business has this dynamic, this sort of tension, this home tension, which is, I'm not working, am I? I mean, you're sort of trying to convince yourself or your partner or your children or whoever else that you're not working, but because it's actually so enjoyable to do it. But But, you know, so going back to my workaholism, I love what I do, and I feel so lucky to do what I do. And that's the tone that I, as the sort of head of the company, sort of set, for better or worse. We're a very, very hardworking office and a hardworking group of people. And so we stretch those resources as far as we go. And it's problematic on some levels because I'm at peace with my own addiction to work. But, you know, as a small company, my staff salaries, I'm proud of what I pay my staff, and they have health insurance. I'm really proud of that. But there's quality of life issues, so that if I'm kind of like setting this tone of work where everyone else is then like working like crazy, you know, I'm comfortable taking my work home, but I can't expect my staff people to take their work home. That's not fair, and that's not right. But as it happens, my staff is populated by people who take what we do very, very seriously, and they do take it home to varying degrees between them. And that's both wonderful and deeply problematic.
Amanda, do you ever find that ambition to address a particular issue or to dream up a particular project hits the ceiling of resources?
I actually work backwards. I first look at the resources. Mm-hmm. I say, this is what I have. You know, growing up poor in America will make you... you know, you can make a dollar out of 15 cents, for real. You can make something happen. So the first thing is always to say, okay, what do we have? All right, what do we need? Then ask, do we really need it? Probably not. And you move forward from that. And you can do some really incredible things. So like with Torch Literary Arts, I started that in 2006, knowing that if all I ever have is my personal funds to pay for the URL and the web hosting, there would be a place to publish Black women and girls, period. And that was before Black Girl Magic and all the things I see now that are beautiful, but I love thinking that in the long narrative of writing by Black women, that Torch somehow kept a space. And a lot of people now who are here because of that one small act of saying, okay, I have this small resource, I can do web design myself, so I can do that myself. I don't have to pay anyone to do that. I can make this space available. We early on published work by, we have a feature and a flame and a spark is what they're called. And the flame is a more known author, Black woman author, and the spark is a lesser known, not necessarily younger, but a lesser known writer who inspires them. So everything about Torch was centered around supporting Black women and girls, their voices, and the sisterhood that we have in with each other. So early on we published people, and I wasn't able to pay them, sadly. Now we're at a point where we can offer a small honorarium. But in the beginning, we couldn't pay it all. And people just wanted to be a part of that good work because it was missing from poetry. There wasn't a place like that then. So the first person that we had as a flame was Sharon Bridgeforth. And her spark was Shia Shabazz. Then we had Patricia Smith as our flame. And her spark was Ramika Bingham, who is in the room. Hello. And we had Natasha Trethewey. And we had Tayari Jones. And all of these people came, not because of what we could offer, but because of what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I am, I think, constantly shocked and amazed by the kinds of ambitious, unbelievably high-quality work we are able to publish, despite the fact that we don't have that much to offer in terms of paying writers. We are super excited that we, in the last couple of years, have been able to get enough funds to pay writers very modestly. But I think you know, when you can't offer that much money, you have to offer something. And I think what Guernica has been able to offer and has a reputation of being able to offer is just an unbelievably attentive, deep, experience for the writer, a deep, deep editorial experience, a very, very supportive community, and yeah, and I think the sense of kind of being part of a community, which is what I think being on staff feels like, and I think what being a writer for Guernica also feels like. Because yeah, it's not monetary value. it's goodwill, and it's a sense of being part of something really special. And yeah, I mean, I'm amazed that we publish incredibly complex reported features where writers go all over the place. And I think what we are able to offer is a space for writers to do that project that doesn't quite fit elsewhere. Do the project that's a personal essay with a bit of reporting, with a bit of history that has a weird left turn at the end and allows the writer to kind of nerd out on their philosophy interest or whatever. I mean, I think our kind of sweet spot is our pieces that are personal but speak to something larger very deeply. And in a way, that combination, there aren't that many places for that. It's not all straight reporting. It's not all straight personal essays. It's sometimes more experimental. I mean, so yeah, creating a space where we can help writers fulfill kind of their dreams that they aren't able to kind of accomplish elsewhere and have a really supportive editorial experience is the trade-off.
And you all have a reporting budget?
No.
All right, so do you seek grants from outside organizations and just help from Pulitzer or Investigative Fund? That's
yes. Yeah, we have lots of kind of relationships and connections with various grant-making organizations, so we're able to send writers in those directions. And then, but we have a very modest stipend that we pay all of our long-form nonfiction writers, and it's nowhere. I mean, it's unbelievably nowhere near what it costs to write the pieces they write. So.
Yeah, and I will say just with my experience at BQR. The only way we can afford our reported pieces is through the funding and the generosity of outside organizations. And when in thinking about this intersection of politics and literary values, it's a little bit tricky. And I wonder if any of you could speak to this as well. You know, we're generally on the same side, same team, but the thing that has always attracted me to literary journalism and narrative journalism, this and the reporting that we do, are these unresolvable questions. This gray area, and I always look at a story, no matter what we're tackling, through the lens of character, just because of my own background in fiction, and I find that that's just a very good vehicle through which you can access policy, you can do all kinds of things, and so when we're negotiating for however many thousands of dollars to send someone to whatever part of the world, or to just do a story for 6 months to a year, you know, there's a very careful dance that we have to do in terms of satisfying what we're trying to get out of it aesthetically and what they expect, whatever the organization is looking for, because there is an agenda. I mean, that money is, whether it's the Ford Foundation wants to fund stories about economic inequity, and which is all fair. But what I try to avoid at the magazine is doing, you know, and again, we fail in this regard sometimes, but to try and avoid as much as possible advocacy journalism where you know exactly what the story is going to be by the time you get through the deck. Because that's just not a very interesting literary experience. I think it's prescriptive, and I think it's important work, but there are plenty of magazines and publications and websites that do that. People come to us for that kind of strange residue that's left after you complete, you know, you finish the experience. And I wonder if any of you have had to negotiate those kinds of circumstances where here are the resources you desperately need to do what you need to do, but you still want to do it your way. And so you have to sort of satisfy the source of that funding, but also, you know, remain true to the kind of vision that you have. And if not, then, you know, good for you.
Well, I've always operated under the belief that not all money is good money. It's okay to say no to money. And when you're part of something, especially that's already been established and is there for a long time, you can't go back in time and change how the legs were set up on the table, okay? So that makes for a difficult challenge to keep all the pieces moving when you know your budget has to hit this, you have to do this, and you do have to answer to other people. So in that regard, I can't offer much help because I knew that from the beginning when starting, and I said I will not let that happen because I'm trying to make a space for Black women and girls to be free. So I'm not going to initiate that space already being chained and bound to answering to someone else. So yes, we have a board, you know, we have people who have input in those things, but it was very, it was worked out in a very specific way to not have, again, not have that be our drive, is to have to answer back to some other party because they have supported us financially. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't great opportunities to, you know, work with organizations. There are some really great foundations out there that are doing important, good things, but the bulk of the funds that we get for Torch Literary Arts actually comes from individual donations. And so that comes from the people who are, again, they showed up because they wanted to be part of it in the first place, so then they funded. We had one annual online fundraising campaign. They make their donations then, and that money then gets cycled back through to go directly back to them. It pays for our wildfire, Torch Wildfire reading series. We're able to pay the features money to come. And again, it's not as much as they deserve or should be paid, but it does. It's enough that it means real groceries and a bill paid. You know, I don't care. I tell them, I don't care what you do with it. I'm just glad it's yours now. But I made sure that when I set that up, it was, again, it was always come back to, if all I ever have is this online address and space to publish their words, then that's enough. And everything else that's come to add, you know, I look at it like that table. Those are my four legs. What's on the table? Oh, there's opportunity for this. Is it a good fit? Is it good money? We can say yes. Great. Now we've got a tablecloth. Okay, great. Next thing, oh, that's a good opportunity there. We've got someone who wants to offer this resource that can publish something for us that we don't have to pay for the publishing, the printing fees. They're going to take that on. Great, now we got China. But if we had to strip all that back, the table's still there. The legs are still there. Those voices are still heard.
Right. One thing I like to say, and I point this out to my staff and other people from time to time, is I just think it's in the literary world, but I think what Amanda was just saying is like a perfect example of this, is that what Amanda was just describing, the chemistry of that, the values of that, of her approach, completely flies in the face of the increasingly corporatized world in which we live. And that is worldwide, and it's most people accept the corporate mandate. The bottom line drives everything. The bottom line is the driver. The dollar is the king, or the yen, or whatever. Money is what it's all about, and we have to do what we have to do to get as much money as we can to for ourselves and for our family, and to succeed in this world. And I find that there's many things about the literary world that I really don't like, but there's a lot that I really do like. My favorite thing beyond the art and the books and the writing is probably this, which what Amanda is talking about, is that what you're doing ignores the corporate mandate. And it's like, no, I am not going to participate in that. That is not going to rule my life. And there's a lot of people in the literary world, a lot of particularly independent publishing, but even to a certain extent at the corporate publishing level, even the major, there's even some of these values even somehow permeate up into the corporate publishing world, where what's driving the bus is not the dollar. And I just think it's so wonderful to be around people that are choosing or that are opting out of where the world is heading. And you know, you look around and the best and the brightest are just sucked up by corporations, and it's like soul sucking. And there's a lot of people in the literary world where are just choosing a different path. A lot of us are able to make that choice because of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And that points to some of the things I don't like about the literary world. But everything that you've said to me suggests that it's not privilege that allows you to make it. It's passion and commitment.
Oh, it's definitely privilege too. I mean, when I said that earlier, you have to constantly check yourself in your positioning. And that's something that just as a human being, either you're going to want that and work for that, and it's a practice and it takes time because this world is not set up that way. It is, as you said, it's very corporatized and capitalism is key and money rules everything. So you have to constantly check where you are. We're all sitting in a ballroom right now in Tampa, in a very nice place, very nice hotels. It's very privileged just to be in this room. So being here, then you have to ask yourself, what are you going to do with this opportunity? What are you doing with the resources? What are you going to say when somebody dares to let you speak into a microphone? Always constantly checking that and knowing that you're fighting against the real evils in the world that already want to manipulate that. They already want to twist that, or if they can't control it, silence it, right? It's just constantly having to ask yourself, are you taking up space? If you are, why? Who did you bring with you? Who did you leave out? Why? Constantly doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no getting around the fact that writing is an expensive endeavor simply because of the amount of time that it takes up. So on a certain level, one can understand the temptation of going to a corporate publisher that can pay you an advance, you know, 50,000 advance on a book, 28% of which will disappear in a year through taxes. If you have an agent, another 15% gets taken away, and then you've got to go report something. I mean, especially if we're talking about politically
Absolutely.
Engaged content, it's investigative journalism. You've got to now start after you've gotten the advance. Not only do you have to write, but now you have to go look for more money. Because certainly that's not enough to pay all your bills and travel to wherever you need to travel in order to do the reporting that you need to do. So it's a quandary, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, it feels like an irreconcilable tension, like this idea that, you know, I love that Guernica, as you were saying, is a kind of publication that because we don't have money, our values are not about money and are not about... we're not responding to those forces, and so we're able to have this kind of sprawling staff, and we're able to do a lot more because everybody who's part of the magazine is part of it because they want to be a part of it, and I think we would never be the publication that we are if we were three staff members who were getting paid and that's what we were doing, you know. But on the other hand, I mean, the more, in a way, that we celebrate writing as this kind of community service thing, the possibly less we will be able to ultimately make a living from this work, right? Like, in kind of stepping aside from the monetary landscape and devaluing, in a way, this work by choice or by necessity, what does that mean for our ability to be taken seriously and to be able to live in this world where money does matter? I mean, I don't know.
Just one thing to add on in terms of the irreconcilability of it. I have some strong anti-corporate feelings, but I'm not a purist. And one thing that really bums me out is when fellow independent publishers feel betrayed by their authors when their authors take a big advance from a big company. Because I before I was a publisher, I was a rock and roll musician. I had a good musical career. My band, at a certain point, we were like at the top of like the indie rock world. And we were with a really righteous independent label. We were doing really well. Our audiences were getting bigger. We were selling a lot of records. And we were one of the, at a certain point, we were sort of one of the most successful, like true indie bands. None of us had health insurance. Even at the top of that sphere, none of us could afford health insurance. It wasn't until we then signed a record deal with Geffen Records, who like radically overpaid us, that we that we were all then able to get health insurance. So when I hear a fellow independent publisher talking about how some author has betrayed them because they went to Simon and Schuster, I think it's such bullshit because of like what you were saying, Paul. And you know, it's like, if you're not giving, if someone doesn't have health insurance, you can't say shit. You know, like that's to me, in American society at least, is like, well, it's not a clear line, but if there is a line between like middle class and not being middle class, it's kind of health insurance. And so to stand in the way of someone, an author, an artist, a creator, a journalist, being able to have health insurance, to me is completely inexcusable. So I never feel betrayed when our authors go and move up to like a bigger company. What I would make me feel betrayed is if they treat us like we were like yesterday's news or we're small beans. I've had that happen once or twice, but many more times I've had authors who, where there's, the relationship is characterized by mutual respect. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yes, we all win. And who knows better what an author and artist needs than themselves? To presume that I, as like the business owner, know what's better for them and better for community than they do, right, is incredibly arrogant.
Well, also to that though is, there are daily needs. Living is real. Being able to take care of your family is real. So we do have to step into spaces. And Mahogany Brown, my dear friend and fellow co-organizer of Black Voice Speak Out, has helped me with that in a lot of ways, as far as reminding me that you can make change from within. And I think the criticism, the backlash isn't so... There's some when you just say yes to the thing, and there's... That's complicated and wild for different people as to why they said yes to some opportunity, some payment, some whatever. But once you're there, again, how are you using that privilege, that moment? You can take that paycheck, you can show up in that room and still say what needs to be said and still not be bought, right? But when that doesn't happen, that's where the betrayal feels, right? That I helped you get to this point and now you're going to allow that offer to silence you, or the work that we've helped build up. So
that's
there's
right.
There's that, right? I'm thinking about Roxane Gay, and she had Hunger.
Oh, right.
Was with, Simon & Schuster. And she pulled the book because they were also publishing, Who I Shall Not Name. they were publishing this terrible author who was hate speech, and it was against everything that she believed in. And she acknowledged, yes, this is a very privileged moment that she could say no, because she can still keep her lights on and she can still do the work she needs to do. And her book, of course, is published elsewhere. But to be able to say, if I'm going to be in this house, if I'm going to be in this area, even if she would have said yes, she still was saying and bringing light to all of the problems and needs that had to happen in the literary world, right? I've also seen people not going into, I mean, there's been so much, we all know, it's smooth Google literary hot mess if you want to know what's going on in the literary world. There's enough. But so someone not as acclaimed as Roxane Gay, I won't say their name, but they were accepted by a strong mid-level, indie press for their debut collection. And there was a lot going on that was problematic with that press. And this young writer, author, who had been working 7-8 years to get this first book published, pulled it after it had been accepted, after it had won a prize. And she said, I just can't. And I believe it did ultimately get published somewhere else, but that was taking a huge risk. Because what if it didn't? What if it didn't get picked? What if that had tainted him? You said something about people taking you seriously. If other people are gonna take us seriously in our work, I'm not so much concerned with that, because if somebody is already looking at you to judge you, that's already happening, right? People are assessing you, or whether you're worthy, whether you're not. If anything, I'm trying to push that as far out of my mind to be able to get to the work that needs to be done, and the right people will show up in the room, the right people to submit, the right people to fund. Everything works out how it needs to be, as long as you stay focused on the thing that needs to be done. Right. So, yeah, sometimes it is stepping into the room and taking the money or taking the grant. And I was at a talk once. Angela Davis said something really amazing. I want to say it was her brother was like an executive at Xerox or some large company like that. And that felt very, like it was going against all the work that she's doing. It's like this huge corporate exec job in your family. You're Angela Davis. Angela Davis. And she said somebody had to be in that position. He also helped write all of the anti-discrimination, language in the company, and he was a part of that work too. So I think for the most part, it's about staying true to integrity when you're doing the work, and knowing when you say yes, continue speaking out. But when you have to say no, you do have to say no.
I want to ask you all this and make sure that, I encourage any of you to jump in. Make sure you have time to ask your questions and have them answered. How do you measure the return on your investment in a story or a project, especially one that's politically engaged? Is a profound aesthetic experience enough, this idea that you might change hearts and minds, or however you want to phrase it? Or, do you need to see measurable consequences, actual change, whether it be in policy or just see some traction in that? I think just personally, when think about VQR, we do a lot of these policy pieces, and we invest a lot in them. Really proud of them, and they'll get out. I mean, really important pieces on healthcare, immigration, etc. And oftentimes there's crickets on the other end of it, and it's disappointing. And in the community of readers and writers who read the piece and they just talk, they praise it, this writer did such a great job, so on and so forth, but we just don't have the machinery to get that story out there and get that person on radio and what have you. So we, many times I have to live with just the idea that it was a good story, well told, and that it's out there. I wonder how you all sort of position yourself in terms of what you expect, especially for those stories, if it's a long one. Or whatever you're trying to achieve that really demand a lot of sweat. Any of you can jump in.
I was definitely, I have some thoughts. It's a tricky question because, I had the feeling from publishing a lot of books, sometimes to me, I feel like the success has already happened once the book is published. This thing is so beautiful, it's so brilliant, and it's incredible, and I'm proud to have had a hand in getting it out to the world. But on the other hand, if only 25 people buy that book, mm-hmm. The word publish, I think, is like rooted in the same word public, So it's like without an audience, then what's the point? So there sort of has to be an audience. But on the other hand, going back to what I was saying, it doesn't have to be all about the dollar. It doesn't all have to be about the dollar bill. And something I was very proud of with a book that we published, we recently started a sports imprint, which about the nexus between sports and social justice. That Eton Thomas book I mentioned earlier is on the imprint. Another book that we published was a book called, on that imprint, Unsportsmanlike Conduct was the title, and the subtitle was College Football on the Politics of Rape. And what it was an exhaustively researched book by a great journalist named Jessica Luther, and she researched every single case that she could find where, since the late 70s was when they first started showing up, of where a prominent college football player had been accused of sexual assault or rape. And so she looked at every single case and found the patterns. and saw this very, I mean, this is not surprising, but very disturbing nonetheless, pattern of how the person making the accusation, the woman making the accusation, how she is silenced. And it's this conspiracy. The parts, they may not be conspiring together, but whether it's the media, whether it's the athletics department, whether it's the university as a whole, whether it's the alumni, the students, but everyone basically is, you know, things are slowly starting to change a little bit on this, but basically it's like, how can we all sweep this under the rug? And a really, really very, very convincing book, really well done. Soon after publication, there was a nationally broadcast college football game on ESPN. And during the broadcast, one of the two people calling the game, you know, play-by-play people, brought up the book and mentioned the book and read the whole, you know, the whole title and said, you know, because one of the two teams, I think, was Baylor, and there was a recent sort of, you know, big problem with at Baylor involving sexual assault on a football player. And, you know, I don't know if there had ever been a broadcast, a nationally broadcast football game in which the word rape was mentioned on air. And to me, that was, like, profound and amazing, and I even get sort of goosebumps thinking about it now. And, you know, that has nothing to do with sales. A mention of the book on a national broadcast is not going to, you're not going to see a big sales spike. Maybe it'll get other people talking and stuff, but you know, my pride, it had nothing to do with, oh my God, we're going to sell a lot of books now. It was like, wow, this book just entered in the national conversation and in a way that was incredibly unusual. And to me, that was just like a huge success. I mean, that couldn't be taken away, and it's hard to measure. You know, it's sort of tangible, it's sort of not tangible, but I think it's clear that something really unusual happened, in you know, just like, you know, during a college football game.
For me, it really has to do with visibility. The moment that a Black woman sees that her work was seen, is life-changing. I know that happened to me, that happened to so many people I work with, you know, so many people I adore and admire their careers. It first started with somebody saying, I see you, I hear you. So that's the win. That's the win. Everything else is balancing the needs versus wants, but the success is when you know that you're seen, or like a Black Poet Speak Out, I know I'm not, you can't silence me. That's the win. That's what it's for.
Yeah, I would echo that and say that, yeah, it's, I think, you know, very occasionally there will be some kind of tangible effect, but I think more often than not, it's, you create a space for somebody to do something that they are incredibly passionate about, and that leads to them being able to do something else, and something else, and something else. And so many people who have published in Guernica have gotten their agent through the person, through the piece that they published, or that a long-form piece has been the seed of a book. And so I think it is really thinking long-term and thinking about, we're investing in people. I mean, I hate the word investing, but we're nurturing people. We're creating opportunities for people who are going to continue to do amazing things. And I do think that you know, more than an article, a book. I mean, if you can kind of nurture somebody into being able to write a book, books do have a huge amount of impact. Books are still an event when they're published, much more so than an article. And they get on people's desks, they get on politicians' desks, they become part of the national conversation, and it's all just drip, drip, kind of water on a stone.
Mm-hmm. Any questions?
I'm thinking specifically about literary publishing, and specifically about places like VQR and Guernica that have such a long tradition of bringing public, bringing basically literary writers into a position of being public intellectuals. I think about things like the Rebecca Solnit essay that Guernica published, which was like the seed of the idea of mansplaining.
Exactly.
I know from helping edit VQR years ago that there is a surplus of excellent literary work coming in over the transom that is publishable but germane not very far outside of the life of the writer. And I know that there is a sort of a demand on the editorial side, like all of those projects that you wish you had a writer for. You know, so you've got an excess of supply on the literary side, but you have these dream projects that you wish someone would come along to write for you. If you were giving advice to writers, literary writers, people with MFAs, people who come to AWP trying to find places to publish their poems or fiction or personal essays, if you were thinking about how to talk to the literary community about becoming, about sort of imagining a literary identity as a public intellectual, what would you say? When you think about things like the deadline cycle or the news cycle and how you're not in that, or what kind of work you're hoping to do in the culture residually, I'm thinking about the Solnit piece or a lot of stuff that VQR has published, what would you say to the community of writers about what skills you hope they would bring to that kind of coverage?
And for the sake of the podcast, I'll repeat the distilled version of the question. What advice would you give, or what guidance would you give to writers aspiring to be public intellectuals? Is that a fair version?
Sure.
Okay.
That's why you're a good editor.
Do you want to start?
I guess I'll start. I mean, because you all will get a chance to think about it. I'll have to answer on the spot. I mean, the first thing that occurred to me when you're saying that is humility. You know, I think it's a great question, but there's also something dangerous about the idea of someone aspiring to be in that position.
Mm-hmm.
That seems a bit egocentric, and I don't know, that starts to creep toward wanting to engage in this sort of polemical dynamic rather than the exploration of ideas. Again, I keep going back to that, the experience of the unresolvable question. And so I would suspect that many of my favorite public intellectuals, literary public intellectuals, are people who just have found themselves in that position simply by doing good work and asking good questions. And people gravitate to that. I don't know if that makes any sense or if that's good advice. I suppose it runs parallel to that idea of, do you want to be a writer or do you want to write? Any thoughts on that?
What you said about the surplus of pieces that are really kind of only germane to the writer is something I think about a lot, and I feel like, you know, that's the bulk of what comes in through Submittable. And I think, personally, I think I am so excited when I see a piece in which the writer has kind of looked outside of themselves, and maybe it's still a personal essay, but they have learned something that they're really excited to share with the world. I think that there's so much more space for people to really tackle social and political issues and bring the imagination to pressing issues around us, I think. I think that's what I would like to see more of.
Any other questions? How are we doing on time? 5 minutes? I want to toss one out there. Johnny, with the Brooklyn Book Festival, and I guess to some degree the same holds for AWP, but for that festival in particular, that's a sort of great venue for the intersection of politics and literature. And I wonder if you can speak to, especially these days, and sort of how that festival is planned with that intersection in mind. You have opportunities for some real combustion, in particular because these are live events, that, you know, the audience is an X factor to a certain degree. And are there any topics or issues this year, perhaps in planning for next year, that organizers sort of just have to think a little bit hard about in terms of whether they want to engage or whether that tension is potentially something that could spoil the spirit of the festival overall. And I ask that simply because this is a pretty unique climate where these conversations can quickly derail. It just occurred to me to ask whether you all ever consider that.
Absolutely. It's a good question. And it's a really tough issue. My perspective is not popular amongst all my fellow Brooklyn Book Festival fellow organizers, and might not be popular with anyone in this room. I feel that the Brooklyn Book Festival, I have to be very careful. I think it's important for there to be tension in programming, not in every program. The Brooklyn Book Festival has, you know, maybe 100 programs every festival. So I'm not talking about every programming, but I'm going to express myself in a way that is not as unpopular as sometimes when I express myself, but I think that there's a real value to having tension and disagreement. You raise a good point that I hadn't really thought too much about, though, is about how combustible it can become. And I think that that's sometimes what some of us organizers fear is, you know, you don't want a program to be a shouting match, you know. But I remember the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books, which is a, you know, very big and great, great festival, has over the years had some really great programs, sort of left-right, mm-hmm. you know, debate programs. And if that can be done very well and picking the right people where it doesn't just devolve into, you know, insults, I think that that can be very important and very, very productive. And I think that that's an area where the Brooklyn Book Festival has room to improve.
There you go.
You did it.
I should be a politician. Did I just say nothing?
Well, yeah, there is obviously some value to that. I mean, I think of that when I think it was the Book Expo, I don't know how many years back, but it was, you know, Bill O'Reilly on the dais with Al Franken, you know, and that thing just went south real fast. And so it's a risk, you know, it's definitely a risk. Yes, ma'am.
The question is, what's the
main thing that our organizations, our respective organizations, are trying to teach people as part of our editorial missions? Go ahead.
Well, with Torch Literary Arts, it's very straightforward. Listen to, read, and believe Black women. And I think the more we do that, a lot of answers for a lot of things are going to come into the room. When you talk about who are, you know, public intellectuals, who are people leading conversations, that too isn't new. A lot of organizers historically, people doing the real meat and potatoes of the work have been women, and especially women of color. So that's something that is a direct point I want people to learn, that I want to share. But then with the work of Black Poets Speak Out, and looking at it, you know, it's a campaign, so it's not like a publishing house in the traditional sense. We're not publishing people. It's inviting people in. And so I guess that would be the lesson in that. Invite more people into the room. look beyond your sphere, look past that, not necessarily for the up-and-coming rising star, but someone who has something that needs to be said. Give them that platform and help them to amplify their voice.
I would say, it would be hard for me to say the single main focus or issue, but there's a little bit of similarity to a few of the things that Amanda just said in terms of, you know, our tagline, which is a bit tongue-in-cheek, which is in our catalog. And by the way, I brought some catalogs if anyone wants to come and grab a copy of our most recent catalog. But our tagline is reverse gentrification of the literary world. I do find, and I think there's some humor in that, just the way those words are put together. But I do find the literary world to be extremely elitist. And it's like a bunch of people in New York City trying to sell books to people who went to fancy universities. And that's completely unappealing to me. I have a background in music, as I've said. And this was something I noticed when I sort of transitioned from music into books, is music, like worldwide, pretty much everybody loves music. Music comes into your ears, and it either goes to your heart or your stomach or your body, your hips, whatever, or it doesn't. But almost everybody has the experience of listening to music and it hitting them and it touching them. Books don't have that, in part because, you know, the words, when you read them on the page, it's just a different, like just physically, it's a different process. But when I started getting into book publishing, I felt like that gap, it'll never be closed, because music is music and there's no competing with it. Or a film, I guess, also film and visual imagery has something that books writing could kind of just can't quite close that gap, but I think the gap can be shrunk down, and the idea that, like, that books, that you need like a fancy college degree to enjoy a book, I mean, I think anybody can read Toni Morrison, not anybody, but anyone with a eighth grade education, you know, can read. That's not quite right. I'm overstating the case there, but I think books are a lot more accessible than the publishing community makes them seem, and so I think that we should be trying to sell books and publish books to a much broader part of the population than what I see most of the literary world doing. It's very, and meanwhile, all those people are talking about no one reads anymore, and, you know, oh, the readership is shrinking, while there's like vast groups of people that they're not even trying to sell books to. It seems very hypocritical to me. And then the second part of my answer is that, which is related, is that I think that for our books, I would like to think that they explore the complexity of the human experience. To give one example of what I mean, one of our areas of focus is Caribbean literature. I think a lot of people have a preset notion of, if I say Caribbean literature, it's like that those words immediately go into a box into certain people's minds. To a lot of people's minds, you know, there's going to be sufferation, there's going to be ganja, you know, and there's going to be music, you know. And it's like the richness of Caribbean culture and Caribbean history, it's just so rich. And there's so many themes and so many perspectives. And so by our publishing Caribbean writers, that's one of the missions there, is to show the culture. Trinidad is practically as rich culturally as the United States, which is, you know, many, 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 many more people. But I really enjoy the process of exploring culture and just sort of broadening people's understanding of culture and the human experience.
Yeah, I very, very short answer. I think we strive to basically expand people's sense of the world through writing that is deeply rigorous and that celebrates beauty and that is honest and true.
What she said. All right, thank you very much, both the audience and the panelists.